Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John. Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you, and good to be here.
Great. Now, we're going to talk about the world of space flights and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies.
But indeed.
First of all, what's going on in space flight and astronomy then, John?
Well, first of all, Dave, I'd like to ask you if you remember about 4 months ago, there was a bit of embarrassment for NASA up at the International Space Station. There were two ladies who were due to go out on the first ever all-female spacewalk, and what happened? There was one spacesuit.
Yep.
Missing.
They have to share a spacesuit. not easy.
No, not quite. They realised that they didn't have two of the appropriate size spacesuits for ladies. Anyway, that has now been put right. One has been taken up there. And on Friday the 18th of October, indeed the first ever pair of ladies going outside the International Space Station. They did that successfully and conducted their spacewalk. So that's a world first, and it was long awaited. So the two lady astronauts, both from NASA, were Christina Koch, who's got an engineering background, and Jessica Mayer, who's got a biology background. Now, for Christina, this isn't anything new. She was one of those two who were due to go out several months ago, and that was her fourth EVA. She was out only the week before, and she'll probably be out again within the next fortnight.
So she's an outdoors person.
Yes, absolutely. Very much so, because she's going to be staying up on the space station for some little while yet. By the time she lands, she will have broken the record for time in space. I think for a lady, I believe the all-time record won't be broken, but it'll be something of the order, just from memory, of 320 or so days she'll have spent up on the International Space Station.
That's a very long
time. It is indeed. Yeah, obviously a very capable and talented lady. The two of them spent quite a time outside. For them, it was a standard mission, they call it, but it was 7 hours, 17 minutes. And what the job was to replace a faulty battery charging unit on the outside of the International Space Station. The space station's got huge, massive solar panels that provide all of the power, and they charge up lithium batteries. Rather, the lithium batteries are now in the process of being put into place. It was the older nickel style, and many of the EVAs, extravehicular activity in NASA speak, have been to replace the old nickel ones with the more modern lithium style. But between the battery and the panel, you have a battery charging unit, and it was one of those that had failed. It'd been there for 19 years, so, you know, that's not too bad.
Seriously, space station's 19 years old.
The space station has been continuously manned since the year 2000. So, yeah, indeed.
Wow, I've forgotten that.
Yeah, that is a... I think people do. We just take it for granted. We forget how long it's actually been up there. It will have been started to be assembled a couple of years before that. I can't remember quite the very first unit that was put up there. In fact, space walks are run-of-the-mill up at the International Space Station. To assemble it, to start with, and it required astronauts outside the space shuttle, for example, bolting or assembling units together, connecting them together. But also there are maintenance walks as well, such as this. And so there have been 221 of those prior to this particular event. And two more are scheduled in the next fortnight, for example. So it just shows you how frequently these take place. But listeners might be interested about women in space. How many have there been? In fact, there have been 15 different lady astronauts who've done a spacewalk. And of those, only one has been other than American. And that was the very first spacewalk by a female, and she was a Russian cosmonaut. But the other 14 have all been NASA American ladies. Now, whilst we're talking about spacewalks, on a sadder note, the very first man to walk in space has just sadly passed away. But he was, I think, twice awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union, which is a bit of a testament to him. And by all accounts, he's an absolutely lovely chap. His name is Alexei Leonov. So his death was announced on the 11th of October. As it happens, Christina Koch was actually outside on one of those missions when Roscosmos announced that sad news. He made the first ever spacewalk a long time ago, March 1965. He was in a two-man spacecraft called Voskhod 2. He was only outside for less than a quarter of an hour or so, but it nearly killed him. The spacesuit that he had on, under the pressure of the air inside, once he got out into the vacuum of space, the spacesuit swelled. Mm. And when he tried to get back in, he was now bigger than the entry
the airlock.
Into the capsule, yeah.
I remember hearing that, and his hands didn't work anymore because the suit was so stiff.
That's right. And what he had to do, the way that the gloves are attached to the rest of the suit is through a twisting action. He was able to undo one of the gloves. And you think you're in the vacuum of space and you've got the presence of mind to do that. And he released some of the air inside. But as a result, he suffered from the bends as a result of the swift depressurization, sort of thing that divers get. So, what a chap. He would have been the first Russian on the moon, and possibly the first man on the moon, if the Russians had beaten America, if the Russians hadn't had problems with their N1 rocket, and the program was eventually cancelled. When listeners go to the slides that support the programme, they'll see some photographs there. One of them was taken by a pal of mine, Max Alexander, who's a photographer. He covers an awful lot of European Space Agency and other space events. One of them is an annual event called Starmus, where all the luminaries from the space community, American astronauts, Russian cosmonauts, all sorts of scientists, Brian May and so on, other musicians attend and have a good time. And one of the photographs is one that Max took, and it's a great photo, shows the first man in space, the first man in a spacewalk, and the first man to land on the moon, Neil Armstrong, side by side. Apparently they became great mates and regularly met at these Starmus events. Alexei had been a bosom buddy of Yuri Gagarin, of course, the very first cosmonaut. The other pictures are one that I took at the Cosmonauts exhibition at the Science Museum a couple of years ago. That's a famous painting showing Alexei outside the capsule. And the other one is of the lander that he would have landed on the moon. It would have been a single person landing and would have required him to spacewalk again from his capsule into the landing, into the lander before descending to the moon's surface. Unlike the Americans who entered the lunar module through a hatch, he would have had to have spacewalked again. But there again, he had experience in that. Okay. Now, these spacewalks I talked about were all about servicing. So servicing the International Space Station. Normally, satellites, once they're launched, have to look after themselves. I suppose there are exceptions. You'll remember that Hubble was serviced by various shuttle missions trying to fix all of the problems with it. But for the very first time, a satellite that's been built to service other satellites has now been launched and is now in orbit. This is a satellite called MEV-1, and MEV stands for Mission Extension Vehicle, and that's built by the American company Northrop Grumman. But it was launched on a Russian Proton rocket at the first week of this month, the 8th of October. The purpose of this is to go up and lock on to a satellite that's up in geostationary orbit, which is 22,000 miles out. So it stays above a certain point on the Earth all the time. It takes 24 hours to orbit the Earth, so appears more or less stationary. And that's where we put many of our big communication satellites. One of them is called Intelsat 901. Now, that has more or less run out of fuel. So this MEV is going up there, will dock with it and take over its pointing and orbital maintenance functions. Intelsat will still keep running on all of its communication jobs. There's nothing wrong with those. But it just hasn't enough fuel to point in the right direction and beam things down to the appropriate ground stations. Interestingly, of course, Intelsat 901 wasn't built with a docking collar. So how does this thing dock with it? Well, they've come up with an ingenious little grasp.
Superglue.
Or better than blue tack. They've come up with a little approach whereby it has Intelsat 901 will have had a rocket exhaust for station keeping and so on. So there's a little probe that gets inserted in that and grips on just using that. So it's quite an inventive approach. But it's the sign of what will be happening in the future. So Intelsat's got another 5 years of its life, they believe, before that will be replaced. And so MEV, which has a 15-year design life, will just shunt it into a graveyard orbit where it will remain safely but out of the way of other geostationary satellites. And then it will trundle off to find another satellite that it's got to go and rescue, yet to be determined, as they won't know which one needs looking after. So I think that's a fascinating concept, and it will greatly reduce the cost of these kind of missions, putting up these very, very large, double-decker sort of size communication satellites, if they can have their lifetimes extended in this sort of way. Now, talking about big things, we've got to talk about SpaceX and Starship One. You might remember, Dave, I talked about they had their first prototype of the new breed of spacecraft last month. It was a little one called Starhopper. Now, that was never intended to be other than a test vehicle for the new Raptor motor. So that's been retired now. But in the interim, well, before, they've been building the very first proper prototype of the Starship. And it's enormous. It's 34 metres tall and 9 metres wide. Now, just to give you a sense of scale, 9 metres wide is 1.5 times the diameter of a Boeing jumbo. All right, so this is big. It's made of stainless steel, where you'd expect it to be more modern materials, carbon fibre and so on. But that's colossally expensive, and you need a very expensive construction facility to build carbon fibre.
But Bruce Willis had a titanium spaceship, so I mean,
I'd forgotten that.
SpaceX would go for that.
That's even more expensive. It's a very special type of stainless steel. I understand it's called stainless steel 301, and don't ask me what that composition is, but it's one that is very strong, easy to weld together out in the open, so it hasn't been built inside a big rocket assembly shed, just out in the open, and also it withstands huge temperatures. This sort of steel needs very little covering on it for re-entry purposes. So overall, that brings the price down below, so Elon Musk says, what it would have been had they used more modern construction materials. So it's all about speed and getting up there quickly. Now, this first prototype was unveiled at the end of September 30th at their place in Texas. And there are three more prototypes under construction at the moment, two at their base in Florida and another one at this base in Texas. This particular one, the Mark 1, will make the first flight, and that will be just 20 kilometres high. And that's just to test out the three Raptor methane-fueled engines that it will have. These are ones that are optimised for sea level, so they'll have their exhaust chamber is a slightly different shape than those that are optimised for space use. So they're gimbaled; they can rotate in the three, several directions for landing purposes. But the Mark IV prototype that's under construction is believed to be in orbit next year. That's the plan. And that will have six Raptors in there. Remember the Super Heavy? This is only the top stage, something this big. Only the top stage. The main booster that will put it up with its full load will be called the Super Heavy. And that will have up to 37 of these Raptors. That produces 16 million pounds of thrust. The Saturn V, the world's biggest up until then, it was 7.8 million pounds of thrust. So this is monstrous. The full stack of the Starship on top of the Super Heavy is 118 metres tall. And both were fully reusable and come down and land on their tails, just like Dan Dare. Okay. Now, different sorts of rockets, launches. You might remember last month, Dave, do you remember I mentioned Virgin Orbit and their Boeing 747? Yeah, that was
making progress.
Indeed. Listeners will see in the set of slides a picture of the red arrows flying in formation with this Boeing Cosmic Girl, their 747. Now, the red arrows have just had a tremendous tour of North America where they went down a bomb, apparently. But the reason for them flying with this Cosmic Girl is because the RAF have just signed a contract for satellites to be launched by Virgin Orbit. And the reason for that is to study the RAF's use of small satellites. Their idea is to stream appropriate battle data directly into the cockpit of our warplanes, rather than rely on reconnaissance aircraft or ground stations. This will come from above, so something that's seeing exactly where the enemy is and what's where, and communicate that directly, as I say, to the fighter, the bomber, whatever. So that's the contract, so that's just been signed, and an RAF officer, Flight Lieutenant Stannard, has just been seconded to Virgin Orbit to work with them on this project for the next 3 years. So quite a plum posting for him. I'm sure he'll have great fun. Whilst we're talking about airdropped launches like that, dropping a launcher from the aircraft up high, Northrop Grumman have just put one into orbit using this approach, but instead of a 747, they use a modified Lockheed L-1011, or as we would tend to know it, TriStar. If you remember that airliner, a jet in the tail, just below the fin, above the fuselage. And it was one of their Pegasus XL rockets, was dropped by this, and it launched a NASA satellite on the 11th of October. The satellite's called ICON, which is to study the ionosphere, how it expands, contracts, and changes in its behaviour at the edge of space. And another bit of news about airdrop-type launches, the world's biggest plane I reported on back in April, I think it was, April or May's edition, called Rock. Rock was the mythical bird that was so big that it could carry an elephant in its claws. But this world's biggest plane is one with twin fuselage and six engines. So those engines are from a Boeing 747. But that was operated by a company called Stratolaunch, which was set up by the Paul Allen, who was the joint founder of Microsoft. And he died last October. So Stratolaunch has been in a sort of stasis since then. But apparently that company and the plane has now been bought by somebody whose identity isn't yet known. Some mystery shopper, mystery buyer, has bought it and plans to do the operation. But this is a step up. The Lockheed TriStar or the Boeing 747 of Virgin Orbit can launch one of these launchers at a time with a satellite. This thing is so big that it can take three of these launches and put three satellites up, or three different payloads, different orbits and so on, from one mission. So we'll be hopefully seeing that in the air working again, hopefully before too long. Okay, now let's move out of our solar system for the moment. We're staying in it in a way. A prize that we're all familiar with, of course, is the Nobel Prize. And the Nobel Prize for Physics has just been awarded for astronomy-type work. And this was to the discoverers of the first exoplanet at a star not unlike our Sun, a main-sequence star. Now, this was some time ago.
I was just thinking that. Yeah, isn't it?
They discovered this in 1995, but have just been given the award. I'm not sure the reason for the delay, but at least they've been recognised. So the two guys, Frenchmen called Michel Mayor and Didier Quilles, I think it is pronounced, they discovered this planet, which was its correct identifier is 51 Pegasi B, but they called it Bellerophon after the chap who actually flew the winged horse in Greek myths. The star has been renamed by the International Astronomical Union as Helvetius, after apparently a Celtic tribe that inhabited early Switzerland. Not sure why, but that's what's happened. And the planet has been called Dimidium. Now, this is from the Latin for half, and that's because the planet is about half the mass of Jupiter. So, hence the name. And it was that mass of the planet that led to its discovery. Most exoplanets are discovered by the slight dimming of the parent star's light as the exoplanet travels in front. This one was discovered by the slight wobble in the star's path. The star isn't that far away, only 51 light years, which in our terms is next door. So its path could easily be followed, but it wasn't a nice straight line. It was a little wobble every now and again, and that's because both the star and the planet orbit a common centre of gravity, and so the star slightly wobbles as it travels. So the planet is one of these that's now called a hot Jupiter, you know, a gas giant, but very, very close to its parent star. And, you know, that has caused all sorts of problems because, according to our theories, planets as big as Jupiter shouldn't form that close to a star. So people now believe that's because the planets form and then migrate to different orbits, some of them migrating in. But since those days, over 4,000 exoplanets have been discovered, as I think I've mentioned before. No, they didn't get the whole of the Nobel Prize. They shared it with, again, somebody working in this area. That's a chap called James Peebles, and his work is on the theoretical discoveries of the early universe. Physical cosmology is his field. And I will keep it in our solar system for the next subject, which is the idea of hunting for asteroids. Last month, you might remember, we talked about dinosaurs getting wiped out, and I remember by the huge asteroid that took out all of them in 66 million years ago, and I mentioned Carl Sagan's line that the dinosaurs would have survived if they'd had a space program. Well, we do have a space program, and so we're starting to actively look for these dangerous asteroids. So NASA has just secured funding to develop and launch something called the Near Earth Object Surveillance Mission. So that's going to be a space-based telescope with a half-metre diameter. So it's a reasonably sized telescope. And they plan to launch that in 2025. And it'll sit quite some way out at a place called the Lagrange Point L1. This is a place where more or less the Sun's and the Earth's gravity balance out. So it's a convenient place to drop a spacecraft so it doesn't have to use much fuel in station keeping. You know, the gravity, mutual gravity of the Sun and the Earth tend to keep it in place. So this is dedicated to hunting for small asteroids, unknown asteroids, of 140 metres diameter. That's the sort of size that NASA calculate would devastate a small country if it impacted on the Earth. Now, we know of quite a few of these. 8,778 of these have been identified and their orbits plotted. But the theory is, and the indications seem to be, that there's probably something the order of 25,000 of these that could imperil the Earth. So it really is important to identify them and work out the chances of something hitting, and if it was thought a high enough risk, to try and do something about it. No, it's not. Said Bruce Willis again. It'd be things like just kinetic energy of a solid impactor. Something that fired at it could be enough to deflect its path to pass us by safely. And NASA are going to be trying this out on another mission they've got underway called DART. So more about that when that happens. So, moving on, asteroids. You might remember that when we had Oumuamua, that was thought to be an interstellar asteroid. Then
yeah,
it was reclassified as a comet. But I mentioned last month again Borisov, our second interstellar visitor. Now, that one has been reclassified. It used to be C for comet, 2019 Q4, just an identifier, but it's now been reclassified as comet 2I, I for interstellar, 2 for the second one. So it's definite. It's an interstellar visitor. Still keeping the name Borisov after the amateur astronomer in Crimea who found it, indeed. But people have been studying it. Even Hubble has been turned on it, and there's a picture from Hubble in the slide set. But they've found that it's been behaving the same sort of way as our own comets do. So it's interesting to be able to compare our comet's behaviour with this comet that was formed in a solar system a long, long way away.
Any Windows on it?
Windows or iOS or XP? Okay. So the cometary tail is becoming more evident. There's even faint signs, possibly, of a second tail. We have a gas tail and a dust tail for comets. They aren't sure of the size of the nucleus. It is fairly small, somewhere between just 1 kilometre and 6. The estimates vary between. Interestingly, they've backtracked its trajectory to see where it came from. But they can't say where it came from. All that they've been able to say is, we know where it's been near. And there's a star called Kruger 60, which is 13 light years away, and this comet passed it about 1 million years ago. But when I say passed it, that was only 5.7 light years from that that star. So it's not from that star, but it's been near it. So I don't think there's ever any hope of working out where it will have been before then. But there are some people who are saying, well, we could actually start to design a mission to catch up with it. It's tearing through the solar system at something of the order of 100,000 miles an hour. And it'll be leaving our solar system, after it's passed through. The closest to the sun is on the 6th or 7th of December, and then it starts to leave. But they reckon we could catch up with it by about the year 2045. If we started designing that mission now, the idea being to launch after it's gone past, but catch up with it eventually and fly alongside it and study it. So great if that happens. Now, Mars. You remember that I landed, or rather my name, amongst about 6 million other names on,
you did indeed,
on the InSight lander. Well, that lander has just been photographed on the surface from above. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has just sent back tremendous pictures showing InSight. And the detail is astounding. You can actually see the two solar panels opened up. You can see the main body of the spacecraft. And then there's a little white dot next to it. And that's the instrument package that it's deployed, which has got the seismology experiment looking for Mars quakes or looking for meteorites, the little tremor in the surface from a meteor or an asteroid hitting the surface of Mars, and also the probe. So in the slide set, there's that picture is included. Now, talking of the probe, you might remember that the probe stopped hammering because it just couldn't make headway. And everybody was worried, has it struck a big rock? It got about 15 centimetres down, then stopped. So they have reported in the past how they used the remote, the manipulator arm on the lander to lift off the cowl, which was above the probe, so that they could see down. And there was a girt big hole around the probe because the soil wasn't the sort of soil they expected. Therefore, it wasn't the sort of soil that the probe was designed to work in. It coagulated in a different sort of way and left this hole. So that meant there was no friction, which is what the mission needs so that it can work properly. Anyway, they've come up with some ingenious ideas of how to get it working again. At the end of the arm, there's a scoop. So they've scooped some of the surface soil into the hole, and then they've turned the arm up so that its fist side is down and compressed it. They've banged it on the surface and have compressed the soil around the hammer, the probe again. Not only that, they've then put that scoop against the probe, pressing it up against the wall of the hole. Yeah, the wall of the hole. So it's now got the friction it needs to work, and it started working again. they've done it. That's incredible. It's ingenious. So, you know, hats off to NASA for this. I think it's made another 3 centimetres. That was the last that I saw. Of course, what the hope is that, you know, if they keep doing this as it gets deeper, keep compacting it, then maybe it'll start to work without the extra help. There'll be enough material there to provide the friction. That's the hope, because the intention was, I think, to go down as far as about 5 metres, so it could study the heat flow, the different temperatures within the surface of Mars. What sort of gradient did that have? So well done, then. There's on the next slide that people will have a look at, I've also provided the URL of this, because it's a good little video for people to watch. We talked in the past about the very first image taken of a black hole, or rather not the black hole itself, but the shadow and the highly illuminated gases surrounding the black hole, because that material is just accelerated to such a huge rate that it gives off radiation before it gets absorbed by the black hole. Now, the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center have now done some more computer modeling, you know, from that to show how black holes warp the space around it. It's a bit like when you go, Dave, into a fun fair and you go into the Hall of Mirrors and you stand and look at yourself in the Hall of Mirrors. You think, well, I was never that shape. But you get these distorted images, and that's exactly the sort of effect that the black hole has as it's distorting gravity. Light is bent in the same sort of way. So it's a fascinating little image and a video, and I do encourage people to go and have a look at that little video clip. So some news in brief now, as I'm running out of time. Going back to the International Space Station, we've been taking astronauts up there only in the Soyuz, the Russian capsule. But NASA has contracted commercial suppliers, and there's two main ones. That's Boeing and SpaceX. SpaceX have had their mission up to the space station unmanned with their Crew Dragon. That happened a little while ago. But Boeing has just announced that it will have its own similar unmanned test, and that will be on the 17th of December. And their spacecraft is called Starliner. CST, Commercial Space Transport 100, Starliner is its full name. So that will go up, dock with the space station, and will then separate, return, and parachute down. The SpaceX one lands like Apollo did in the sea with a flotation kit. This one parachutes down and lands on the sand in the same way ground on the same way that the Soyuz does, with some retro rockets. So that's targeted to land in White Sands, New Mexico. SpaceX have their next milestone test of the Crew Dragon in late November or possibly early December, and that's to fly the Crew Dragon capsule on a rocket and then demonstrate that the abort rockets can whisk the capsule away from what might be an exploding launcher. So that has to be tested before it can be man-rated and take astronauts up to the space station. So that milestone will take place fairly soon. They've also announced at SpaceX that their next launch of the Starlink satellites will use a Falcon 9 that has been launched 3 times previously. So that will be the first time that we'll see the fourth reuse of a booster. It shows how we're progressing in that way, that we can launch something, do a minimal bit of refurbishment, and then they can use it again. And SpaceX are the leaders by far in this field. But 60 of these Starlink satellites that they'll be launching, 60 in one go, which was quite a sight when they launched them in the first instance. But there is concern now in the scientific community about these. They are undoubtedly going to be, have their beneficial side, because they're to provide internet communications to parts of the world that just don't have it. We take the internet for granted, but there are huge swathes of the world that don't have it, Africa and across oceans and so on. But SpaceX are saying that to get this coverage complete, they'll probably need to launch 30,000 of these Starlink satellites. That's 60 at a time. That's an awful lot of launches. They've already scheduled 14 of these launches for next year. There are concerns that scientific studies from Earth-based telescopes, whether optical or radio, will be disturbed, affected by all of these tiny satellites skimming across the sky. And the next thing to report, Dave, is we always thought that Jupiter was the king of the planets. Indeed it is, in terms of size, but also we thought in terms of the number of satellites it has. That's gradually been creeping up over the years. I remember as a boy, I remembered that Jupiter had 12, but the count now is 79, but Saturn has just overtaken it. There's a team in Hawaii using the Subaru telescope on Mauna Kea. They've just had a period of study which has resulted in 20 more satellites being found. They're very small ones, 5 kilometres in diameter or so. So that means Saturn now has 82. So it's overtaken Jupiter. So there you go, Dave. That's my roundup of things that have interested me since we last broadcast together.
Thank you very much, John.
Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month.
And what is your constellation then, John?
You're getting two for the price of one today, Dave. It's not just one constellation, Pegasus, but the one right next door to it, Andromeda. You'll find two different descriptions in the slides and pointers, of course, to the video clips as well. So Pegasus and Andromeda actually share one star between them, called Alpha Rats. As I say, closely located, but lots of lovely objects in there, galaxies, globular clusters, nebulae as well. And nicely placed for this time of the year.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now then, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Okie doke, Dave. Well, some good constellations coming up. But if I may, just a couple of quick notices before I get into those. One of our prime scientific research places within our area is the Mallard Space Science Laboratory at Holmbury St Mary. And they are holding an open evening on Tuesday the 29th from 7 o'clock till 9 o'clock. If people are interested in that, and I don't know yet whether there are still spaces, I hope there are, but the telephone number is 01483 204 200 to inquire about that. There'll be a couple of lectures, one about black holes, another one about the aurora, and another one about building telescopes for use in space. And my society, Guildford Astronomical Society, will be there with telescopes, weather permitting, to show visitors the night sky. So if there are still spaces, then take the opportunity and pop down there. The other thing to mention is the transit of Mercury on the 11th of November. So there are only about 14 occasions you could see this every century. So the next one won't be until 2032. So it's a chance to see Mercury. It'll only be a tiny, tiny black dot passing across the face of the Sun. Now, of course, never look at the Sun with your own telescopes or binoculars. You really need to have appropriate filters. But astronomical societies such as Guildford and others will have those pieces of kit. So check your nearest astronomical society's webpage. Are they holding an event? Guildford plan to do so, haven't yet decided exactly where, but there will be one. So this is on the afternoon on the transit for the transit of Mercury of the 11th of November, from 12:35 until sunset, which is at 4:20 on that day. However, of course, you've got to remember that it is November, and what's the weather usually like in November? Often quite cloudy. So we are in the lap of the gods for that. But there will be the appropriate telescopes held at various events so that it's quite safe for you to see. One thing you can do at home is to set up a telescope pointing towards the Sun, and you can never, you know, try and find it using your spotting scope or anything like that, but just use the shadow of the telescope so you know it's pointing at the Sun, and then project the Sun's image onto a piece of white card. That works quite well, but remember, don't do that for too long, because the inside of the telescope will get rather hot, and you don't want to melt any of the parts of the telescope, particularly if it has some plastic parts. So do watch out for that. And one last final little notice, if I may. I mentioned last month that the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich are holding two separate exhibits at the same time, exhibitions. The Moon, until 5th of January, and Astronomy Photographer of the Year until 26th of April. And both of those were £9. They're now doing a combined ticket, so you can go on the same day to both exhibitions for £13.50, so quite a saving. But that is if you book online. If you just go on the day, then it's still a saving, but it's £15 and half price for children. Now, let's move on to the question you asked me, Dave, was what we're going to see in the night sky, the constellations visible and so on. Well, obviously, my two for the month, Pegasus and Andromeda, more or less overhead by about 10 o'clock mid-month. And then a little bit further down, we've got Perseus. Cassiopeia is well placed too. And we're starting to get some other well-identifiable constellations up, like Taurus, and, of course, Orion is now making an appearance in the evening sky. So lots of good stuff to get out there and look at. If you want to be looking at the Moon, the best time to do that is the 4th of November, when it's at first quarter, or the last quarter, fortnight later, on the 19th. Do remember, of course, that the Sun is rising later and later and setting earlier and earlier. So by the end of the month, the Sun sets before 4 o'clock, just 2 minutes before, and rises at the start of the month by just about 7 o'clock. So we're getting nice long nights to do some observing. In terms of the planets that we'll see, Mercury starts off just about visible, but very poorly placed, as it's very low and so gets lost in the twilight after sunset in the southwest. But it becomes a morning object after the transit of Mercury, and it can be seen probably best from about late month, 20th onwards, in the southeast, rising about 1.5 hours before sunrise. Venus is a very brilliant evening object, incredibly bright in the southwest, but again fairly low, setting about 50 minutes after sunset to start at the start of the month, hour and a half by the end of the month. Mars is beginning to come good. It's a morning object, and it's improving as the month draws on, rising by about 3 hours before the sun by the end of the month. But that will improve as the months roll by, and next year it's going to be an excellent apparition of Mars. Jupiter, more or less lost this month because of twilight. Can be seen for some of the month very low, but you do need a good low horizon to find it. Saturn's still okay in the south to southwest for the first half of the month particularly, but gradually starting to get lower and lower. Uranus, very well placed, but obviously you need a good telescope to find that, as it's not really visible otherwise. And similarly, Neptune. So your appropriate star maps should show the position of Uranus and Neptune, or use a good package like Stellarium. Freely downloadable, but they're great for helping you to find objects in the night sky. As we've still got a few days of October to go, I thought I'd also mention that on the 29th of October, the moon will be, a very thin crescent moon will be very close to Saturn, just a little bit above it, so that will help you to find Saturn on the 29th. And on the 31st, the moon will be close to Jupiter in the evening. Using the moon to find the planets is a good way of finding your way around. And don't forget, the clocks go back on the 27th. Now, into November it's proper. We've got the moon fairly close, but a little bit to the left of Saturn on the 2nd. I've already mentioned the transit of Mercury on the 11th. 2 days after that, on the 13th, the moon passes through one of the easily visible star clusters called the Hyades. This is in the constellation of Taurus. So that makes quite a nice sight. It's a V-shaped cluster, and the moon will be passing through that on the 13th. We've got a meteor shower on the 17th and 18th, it's the Leonids, which can be a really good shower, but the theoretical max for this year is just about 20 or so per hour. And the moon, as so often, will wash out, the light from the moon will wash out the fainter meteors, so don't expect to see 20, but you will see some. Venus and Jupiter are quite close over a period of 3 days, from the 23rd to the 25th. So you'll easily find Venus low in the south western sky, and that is so bright. But the near bright thing to it is Jupiter. So they'll only be just over a degree and a half away, that's three moon widths, on the night of the 24th. But look, 23rd, look on the 25th as well, still nearby. On the 25th, the moon is also quite close to Mercury as well. On the 28th, Jupiter is actually occulted by the moon. That means the moon goes in front of Jupiter in daylight. So you would need to have a telescope. A telescope will show you Jupiter in daylight if it's pointed in the right place. So point at the moon and look nearby, and you'll see a bright speck, and that is Jupiter, and it will disappear behind the moon, reappearing again at 10:30 in the morning. Also, that day, earlier in the morning, you'll see Venus and the Moon, as well as Jupiter and Saturn, all reasonably quite close together, just after sunset. Sorry, I said the morning, didn't I? I meant the evening. It's after sunset. interestingly, the space station also goes past this little grouping of planets at about the same time, about 10 past four or thereabouts. Okay, talks at local societies on the 7th of November, Thursday, at the University of Surrey. Guildford Astronomical Society's talk is Black Holes That Feed on Galaxies. These are the supermassive black holes at the centre of galaxies. And that's by Dr. Lee Morabito, Leah, from the Centre for Extragalactic Astronomy at Durham University. Farnham Astronomical Society on the 12th at Aldershot Cricket Club have a whistle-stop tour of the planets by William Joyce, who I think is one of their own members. Croydon Astronomical Society, Royal Russell School in Croydon, two meetings, three meetings in November, in fact. Friday the 1st, Supernova, again, The Exploding Universe by Dr. Heather Campbell, who's from here, from the University of Surrey, the Department of Physics. But the other two meetings on the 15th and the 22nd haven't been announced in terms of what the subject is as yet. Keep your eye on their website if you're in that part of the county. Yule on Astronomical Society, who meet at Nonsuch, Friday the 8th. It's 1 month to save the Hubble telescope by a very good speaker, I know, Graham Bryant. He's the chair of Hampshire Astronomical Group and also one of the lecturers at the South Downs Planetarium as well. Walton Astronomical Group are going to be holding one of their stargazing sessions on either Friday the 22nd of November or Saturday the 23rd, 8 till late, depending upon the weather. So again, watch their website to find out when and where. So that's waltonastrogroup.co.uk. And at the centre of our county, Guildford, we've got, of course, the University of Surrey, and their Department of Physics is holding one of their stargazing astronomy evenings, Wednesday the 20th of November at 7 o'clock. So first thing is a talk in Lecture Theatre E, title and speaker yet to be announced, and then that will be followed by stargazing, if clear, using their telescope at their dome, or a talk about the night sky indoors if cloudy. It's a free event, but as always for these sorts of things, numbers are limited, so you do need to book via their astronomy website. So look at the university's website, find the physics department, and then look at their events page for outreach events. And last of all, the sky at night. We've mentioned in the past Comet 67P, Gerasimov, Churyumenko, such a difficult name to pronounce. So that mission has, of course, finished now, the Rosetta mission to that comet. But scientists have still been studying all of the data that has been received, and more discoveries have been made since the space mission ended. So the team, the Sky at Night team, are revealing some of these discoveries that are revolutionising our understanding of comets, including the discovery that shows the crucial role that these space rocks may have had in life starting on Earth. So that's the subject of the Sky at Night on Sunday the 10th of November, BBC 4, 10 o'clock, repeated on Thursday the 14th of November, BBC 4 again at 7:30. And Dave, that's your lot.
Thank you very much, John, for that fascinating insight. Now, this show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday 29th of November.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Extell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.